What this is a handout. It has a little bit of what I put on this morning on the board, but it has a lot more. It's just still a scratching of the surface. But I thought I'd go through this a little bit with you, and then I've picked out one or two of the additional names that I'll make a few comments on in the terms of as time will allow. We talked about Elohim. We talked about Yahweh. And if you turn it over, we talked about Adonai this morning. Now back to the front. Elohim, as does Yahweh or Jehovah, is also often combined with additional words to make a compound name. I would say probably the most familiar to our ears is of Elohim would be El Shaddai. And that is normally translated in the English Bibles as God Almighty. So when you see God Almighty, that's Elohim Shaddai, Shaddai being Almighty. And I just put a few passages there where it is found. Genesis 17:1 would be the first one. El Elyon in their Bible will usually appear as the Most High God, stressing God's strength and supremacy. And the passage there in Genesis 14, this is first used when Abraham and Melchizedek have their encounter there in Genesis 14. El Elom is not as often encountered, but we included it there. When we drop down to Yahweh, the most common one of all compound names probably is the Yahweh Jireh or Jehovah Jireh. And that's the one we first encounter in Exodus chapter 22 when the ram is caught in the thicket and becomes the substitutional atonement for Isaac. And then Abraham says, the Lord will provide. Yahweh Nissa, the Lord is my banner. Sometimes at VBS or in the children's classes, we have our children sing, the banner over us is high. Yahweh Shalom, you would probably get that just because Shalom is fairly common in our knowledge of Shalom or peace in the Psalms. Yahweh Sabaoth, Lord of Hosts, is found several times. Yahweh Makadishim, the Lord is your sanctifier. On the back, it's not the most familiar, but it is and it isn't one of the more familiar ones. Yahweh Roha is the reference that we find, for instance, in Psalms 23, the Lord is my shepherd. Yahweh Tiskuno, the Lord is righteousness. Yahweh Shema, the Lord is there. And Yahweh Elohim Israel, the Lord, the God of Israel. And there are many other Yahweh or Jehovah compounds. We just put those on there. I'm going to drop down to number 4. This is the only thing I'm going to really say about the New Testament and the Greek. But in the New Testament, the most common translation of or root word for God is theos. That is the Greek. And it's somewhat consistent with Elohim, which in the Old Testament is God. Kurios is the Greek word often translated as Lord, stressing authority and supremacy. Now, in the Old Testament, as I put on the board, both Yahweh is translated Lord, all capitals. Adonai is translated Lord with capital L, small o, small r, small d. Kurios is kind of a combination of both of those. In the Greek, they really didn't have two words like they did in the Hebrew for different aspects of Lord. Despotos is not found often, but it is in the Greek word translated master, and it would probably parallel more closely with Adonai, as I talked to you this morning. Father I put that on there not because it's a Greek word. It's just interesting to me that a reference to God as Father is only 15 times in the Old Testament and 245 times in the New Testament. Why is that? Well, I'm going to have to only speculate. Is that even as we got to the New Testament, God is wanting to have that more personal, intimate relationship with us as His children. And there's not many more personal relationships or words than Father. So that's just for you. And again, it's still scratching the surface. If you choose to take that and use that as a springboard for your personal studies, that would be fine. There are numerous books available on the names of God, and you know, it'll be like a 150-page book with as many of the names as they find, and usually those are pretty good. I can't say they're all good, but usually they're pretty good because they don't tend to be doctrinally slanted. It's just what do those names particularly mean? So I wanted to leave that with you while I was with you and before we departed. Okay, what I think I'd like to do now is go to Genesis chapter 22. And this is the one, and I chose this because it's a wonderful one, obviously, but it's one you're familiar with, so I don't have to go back and put a lot of things in context. I referenced it this morning. This is Abraham's trek up the mountain with Isaac. And just maybe try to pull a few thoughts out of it that I had not normally got. Let me put it that way. In Genesis chapter 22, verse 1, it says, "And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt," or test, I think, test Abraham. It's the Hebrew word there is NASA, N-A-S-A, just like our space agency, but obviously it doesn't mean the same thing. It means to test, to assay, to see what he's really made of is what's going on here. God wants to see what Abraham is really made of. And I talked to you a little bit this morning about the evolvement, the growth of Abraham's faith. And I think probably it's not seen anywhere any more than here. There's a German term called Sitzenleben. And Sitzenleben means for the situation in life. And I think this is one of Abraham's Sitzenlebens. He was put in a real interesting predicament, I'm going to call it. It was an illogical predicament that he was placed in. God had already promised Abraham that he was going to have a lot of nations, seeds, multitudes of people from his lineage. Now he's finally got Isaac, and God tells him to kill Isaac. Well, that's going to throw, obviously, kind of a monkey wrench into that first promise. And Abraham may have understood that to some extent. But here, Abraham just finds himself a little bit up against the wall. Maybe you could say it was the bottom of the ninth and two are out. And what do? Kill my son or disobey God? The test just really doesn't seem to make sense. How is he going to have a great nation if he turns around and kills Isaac before Isaac has any offspring? And think of the emotional duress this was going to put on Abraham and Sarah. Can you imagine if Abraham had killed Isaac, going back and telling Sarah what you had done? Now, I don't know whether Sarah knew they were going up the mountain or not. I don't get any indication that she did, but she may have. But it was almost an illogical thing. This would be a case where you would want to look at God and say what? But yet Abraham doesn't do that. He just goes and he does it. And that's probably one of the reasons why God set it up that particular way. God calls in verse 2 of Exodus 22, and Abraham, it says, answers without delay. He said, "Now take your son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest." Interesting, this is the first time the word lovest is used in the Bible. It's not the first time somebody loves somebody, but as far as I can tell, it's the first time this word is used. "And get you to the land of Moriah." Now, verse 3, "And Abraham rose up early in the morning." There was no delay. It was a wonderful example of obedience. Now, as I have read this, and I'm not going to read any more from particularly, I'm not going to read the entire chapter. When I have studied this, or Genesis 22 has been taught to me, well, let me ask you, what is the primary lesson that we should get out of Genesis 22? Okay, that's Jehovah Jireh, so I best not argue with that. God will provide, and how does that apply to us? Obedience? Okay. God provided the lamb, and the lamb was metaphorical for what? Right. The lesson really, and it is the right lesson, is substitutional atonement. In a theological sense, this is substitution. The lamb was substituted for Isaac, which is representative of Christ dying on the cross, substituting, so we don't have to die on the cross. And I don't want to take away from that lesson, but I'm not going to teach that lesson because I think that's pretty well firmly in your mind. But there were a couple of other things, I think, going on here, at least one very important one that I think was going on that you and I have to deal with every day. What Abraham really had to do was make a choice. Now, he had God on one hand, and he had Isaac on the other hand. All of Abraham's blessings came from God. So God was the blessor. What do you think Abraham's most cherished blessing was? Isaac. So now we've got a man, and he's got the blessor telling him to kill or destroy his most cherished blessing. What's going on here, in addition to the substitutional atonement, is a man having to say, do I reverence my blesser more, or do I reverence, or do I value my blessing more? Now, when I think of it like that, it gets real practical for me. Sometimes we have to choose. Do we extol God more, or do the blessings God has given us take a higher priority than the blessor? I don't know if I said that well or not, but Abraham had to choose which is most valuable to me, my blessings or my blessor. We live in a very affluent land. We are so blessed, and we know that, and we say it. But how many times have we seen, or how many times have we been succumbed or tempted to let our blessings come in the way of our obedience and reverence to our blessor? Today, a lot of people aren't in church because they are enjoying their blessings at the expense of worshiping their blessor. That's the choice. You and I, we are blessed, and it's one of the temptations of being so blessed. Abraham had to say, now, who is more important, God or Isaac? Am I willing to give up my blessing, my most cherished blessing, to obey my blessor? Are you and I willing to? Who are the Isaacs in my life? I don't have any children named Isaac, neither do probably none of you do. I don't know that for a fact. But we have to make those decisions. Okay, I can afford a boat. Am I going to ride my boat when I should be worshiping my blessor? Just on and on. I'm not knocking boats. I mean, the boat's fine. But that's the real human decision going on down here. Yes, there is this substitutional atonement. But there's this day in and day out decision that Abraham had to make. Are you willing to give up your family in order to obey the Lord? That's a very practical thing for us today. I have seen, and you have too, person after person after person who, when the rubber meets the road, family takes precedence over God. There's a saying, and I know what it means, I just don't understand where it came from. Blood is thicker than water. And if somebody can tell me what that really meant in its original etymology, I'll appreciate it. I know how we use it. We use it that our physical family is more than our values or more than our religion. So I don't know if the water there refers to baptism, and we put our physical family, blood family, over our brothers and sisters in the Lord. That's really what it kind of means. But that happens with alarming regularity. Now, I know that's hard, but so was it hard for Abraham. At the heart of the tests that you and I, just like Abraham, have in life is the choice between the blessings and the blessor. Now, we needn't give up all of our blessings or any of our blessings, but they have to be subservient to the blessor. And I think that's really what Abraham was showing God here as he went to that. Now, obviously, he says in verse 5, we will return. So he had faith in that. But when you drop down to verse 14, this is where we find the first usage of the term, and Abraham called the name of the place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, in the mount the Lord shall be seen, and Jehovah Jireh means the Lord will provide, as somebody here acknowledged or said unto us. Now, in Hebrews 11, verses 17 and so forth, we do get the indication that Abraham probably believed in the resurrection, so he probably believed, it seems as though the Bible tells us that he felt even if he had killed Isaac, the Lord was going to bring him back to life. Otherwise, the promise of God would have been irrational. But even if I believed that, running a knife through the chest of my child would be a real task. It would be a real tough thing. Even if I totally believe God is going to bring him back to life. But I think in addition to that substitutional atonement is this blessor blessing type of issue. The other point I want to make before I get off of this is in verse 3 I mentioned that Abraham rose up early in the morning. He got right at it. You know, delayed obedience is still disobedience. If Abraham said, well, I'll do it, but let me go do this first, that would have been disobedience. And for us, delayed obedience is disobedience. So, some don't know Jehovah Jireh because God is still waiting for them to do what he has said, and they don't make the right choice between blessor and blessing. We got to remember that our blessings are from the blessor, therefore that's the one that we should adhere to. I'm going to just pause. I don't even know that I expect it, but I'll give you a chance if anybody has a comment or a question. I went over that fairly briefly, fairly quickly, because I know you know the story. What I really wanted to point out was this blessor blessing contrast or dilemma, if you will, that I think Abraham really had to struggle with. And he passed the test in flying colors.
You said the Lord will provide. Which Lord was that?
Jehovah,
was that?
That is Yahweh. Yahweh. In the King James, they actually translated Jehovah Jireh, but it comes from Yahweh there, which is the self-existent personal relationship. It's the one that's used the most often. Okay, let's look at one other real briefly. And this goes back to Genesis chapter 14. This would be El Elyon. And in Genesis chapter 14, we have that used for the first time, if you will. And as I said, this is the encounter with that Abraham has with Melchizedek, which is a rather complicated sometimes study in and of itself. But let's not worry too much about that particular, about Melchizedek. I'm more interested in El Elyon. If you look at Genesis chapter 14 and verse 18, it says, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was priest of the Most High God. Most High God there is El Elyon in the Hebrew. And it's an issue of the Most High God. Now, the context here, you remember why Melchizedek came out and met Abraham? Abraham had gone and rescued some of the people from Lot's and brought them back. And Melchizedek, who was the priest king of Salem, which later became Jerusalem, comes out and meets him. But as you go through this, it becomes rather interesting to note that. Well, let me just read a few verses. I'm going to begin with verse 19 here of this 14th chapter. Melchizedek comes out. He blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of El Elyon, the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thine hands, and he gave him tithes to all." Now, in verse 20 that I just read, who does Melchizedek say delivered these enemies into Abraham, into their hands? He said it was the Most High God. Now, Abraham's the one that actually went out and did it. He took 318 men and went out and did it. So it would be easy to say Abraham rescued these people. But Melchizedek says, no, El Elyon rescued these people. The point being is Abraham was a resource that God used to get it done. But God was the source of it. And that's the point I want to leave you with. El Elyon is an indication that God is always the source of that which happens to us good. Remember James chapter 1 verse 17, every good and perfect gift comes from above. Now, David might do something very good for me. He might even save my life. And that would be pretty high on my list of nice things he could do. But he would simply be a resource that El Elyon, God used to save my life. We might go to the doctor and thank them for saving our lives. And I don't think that's a sin to say that. But the reality of it is, those doctors are simply resources that God has given the ability and the knowledge to do it. El Elyon, the Most High God, is always the source. Everything else that participates in it is simply a resource. And I think sometimes we confuse the source with the resource. And not that we shouldn't be thankful to whomever can do something for us or thank them and pray for them, but they're not the source of it. They are a resource. If you're involved in bringing someone to Christ, you are not the source of it. You are a resource that God is using, but God's the one that does it, isn't it? God gives the increase. So as I look at this passage in El Elyon in Melchizedek's particular case, it just seems to me like one of the things to get out of this, there's a lot of things to get out of the story of Melchizedek, how he was priest and king, and then Christ brought the priesthood and the kingdom back, kingship back together. But there's also this reminder, and it may be a reminder to Abraham that, hey, you are the resource. Not the source. You are the resource that God has used to allow this to happen. Because El Elyon, the God is Most High. He has no equal. He is alone. And while people may worship gods of their own making, there is only one God. There is only the God who is Most High. And as we attempt to look at various names through which God reveals himself, we have to, and I want to restate that God is only one and he alone is God. All these names are simply different insights he's giving us to himself. Paul is an elder. Paul is a husband. Paul is a father. But there's just one Paul. All of those names and titles are just giving us further insights into him. Well, this is what we have with God. So I know no one here would make this mistake, but somebody listening to the tape might think we're talking about plurality of gods. That is not what we're talking about, but each one of these names gives us a fuller and a richer, I think a deeper, it gives me a deeper understanding of what God is. God provides it all, but God is the source of it all. God is our shepherd. And when the Jews would read their scriptures, these different names would say that. Now, we've got the same thoughts, sure. We can get the thoughts without the names. I was telling somebody at the break, I have not bought one, and I probably won't, just because we've probably all got too many, but they just came out with a Bible that has all of the Hebrew names in the Old Testament in it. So when you read Genesis 1:1, it says Elohim. When you read Genesis 2 and 4, it says Yahweh Elohim. When you read Genesis 15 and 2, it says Adonai. And I kind of like that. I really do, because I think as we read through the scriptures, it just gives us a little richer feeling and insight into who our God is. Okay, well, I appreciate your attention. And as a way as an invitation, it's amazing how many euphemisms we have for dying, you know. Some of them aren't very respectful, you know, the kicking of the bucket, buying the dirt. But just passing on. We, death is not a term that we really like to use, but it is a term that we're all going to come with. I spent yesterday about 5 hours with people my age and older talking about the reality of death. But there's one term that we sometimes misapply. And again, I'm not being critical. But we'll use the term crossing over Jordan as a term for dying. That's really not a very accurate term. Now, if everybody knows what it means, that's fine. But that term comes from the children of Israel crossing over Jordan into the promised land. And we think of heaven as the promised land. But where that analogy breaks down is when the children of Israel passed over Jordan, they still had a lot of enemies. They still had a lot of battles. They still had to deal with sin. When we die and cross over into paradise, we don't have any battles. We don't have any enemies. And we don't have any sin. Now, you may catch me using the term crossing over Jordan as a reference to death, but it really is not an accurate statement. Going into paradise, going into heaven, is so much different than the children of Israel crossing over Jordan and going into their promised land, because their promised land has still had lots of difficulties. When we do it, we don't have any difficulties. We don't have any problems. And that's hard to grasp, isn't it? No aches, no pains. Always remember, when you hurt, that's God reminding you He never intended for you to stay here very long. It's God's way of saying, I got something better in mind for you. And we don't want to lose anybody. We don't want to lose ourselves because we love each other. But in reality, Paul was right. I go to a place far, far better than I have ever been. And the more real that I can keep that in my mind, maybe the straighter I will walk. Now, some of you have tiptoed with death much closer than I have. So you can probably articulate this better than I do. But it really doesn't matter, because none of us are going to get out of this alive physically. But we're all going to get out of this alive spiritually if we make the right decisions. If we put the blesser ahead of our blessings. If we remember He's the source, everything else is simply a resource. If we can help anybody, if you've got something to bring before the group or share with the group or come and be part of the family of God or be immersed, I don't know all your needs, what might be in your mind, we set this time aside as we stand and we sing the closing song.